That jarring cacophony concluding with Murray Gold's version of the theme for starting in 2010 tells you you're back with the Power of Three podcast as we continue our Doctor a Day countdown to the new series starring Shuddy Gatwa, and yeah, that song's not really catching on, is it? Anyway, doesn't matter. Today is day 11 of this new run, and of course that means we're featuring Matt Smith's Doctor. And today we're taking a look at a book which was originally released on the 28th of April 2011 during the second run of Matt's Doctor. And we're talking about Hunter's Moon by Paul Finch, not the one from American Pie. What can I tell you about it? Hunter's Moon was the 45th novel in the BBC new series Adventures range, which featured the 11th Doctor, Amy Pond and Rory Williams, and it's got a cover by Lee Binding. Popping it over, the back page tells you there's no end to horror in this place. It's like hell, and there are devils round every corner. Welcome to Leisure Platform 9, a place where gamblers and villains rub shoulders with socialites and celebrities. Don't cheat at the games tables, and be careful who you beat. The prize for winning the wrong game is to take part in another, as Rory is about to discover, and the next game could be the death of him. When Rory is kidnapped by the brutal crime lord Xorg Krautzen, the Doctor and Amy must go undercover to infiltrate the deadly contest being played out in the ruins of Gorgoror. But how long before Krautzen realises the Doctor isn't a vicious mercenary and discovers what Amy is up to? It's only a matter of time. And time is the one thing Rory and the other fugitives in Gorgoror don't have. They are the hunted in a game that can only end in death. And time for everyone is running out. Quite exciting, isn't it? I really enjoyed this one. The fact it's so different from what you would normally expect. It's got some, I think it'd be fair to say, old-fashioned nastiness with Xorg Krautzen and his associates. And it's quite nasty in places, but that's what you'd expect, given that Paul is an accomplished horror novelist. And it's that contrast between this lovely, happy, jolly Doctor and his brilliant friends, and then you've just got this vicious, almost too realistic, one might say, a sort of level of violence, but that's what makes it so good, and the fact, of course, that the Doctor gets out of it. This was released as an audiobook on the 20th of October 2011, which was a complete and unabridged reading from BBC Audio, and it was read by Arthur Darvill. So why don't we hear a brief excerpt?
Malik ran as he'd never run before. He was young and strong, and though he'd been running for hours already, he knew that he could keep going for a while yet. This didn't mean that he wasn't aching all over, that his throat wasn't raw with gasping and panting. The air was foul in this place. It tasted bad. It smelled bad. It was filled with pollutants, but still Malik ran, sucking it in great lungfuls. He was staggering along a corrugated steel conduit. As if such a surface wasn't difficult enough, it was streaked with oil and grease, and strewn with a rubble of broken machine parts. And of course, it was dark. It was always dark here. Inevitably, he stumbled and fell. He landed face first. A jagged edge tore his chin and lower lip, the pain lancing through him. The metallic taste of blood filled his mouth. He spat it out as he hauled himself to his feet. His wheezing for breath was so loud that he imagined it could be heard for hundreds of meters along the conduit. Not that it needed to be, because now, when he listened, he heard a clank, clank of approaching feet. He turned sharply. Around the corner, some 20 meters away, a figure appeared. It was indistinguishable in the dimness, apart from its eyes, from which two red laser beams blazed. They swept from one side of the passage to the next, quickly pinpointing him. Malik shrieked and threw himself to the ground. There was an ear-shattering crump as an energy bolt struck the conduit wall close to where he'd been standing, showering him with red-hot shards. Though dizzied by pain and concussion, Malik wormed his way out through the smoking aperture. There was a drop on the other side, which for all he knew might plummet hundreds of meters onto more piles of scrap, or into a corrosive sludge of waste chemicals. But in fact, he fell no more than a meter, landing on a rickety steel catwalk which shuddered as he stumbled along it. A ladder appeared to his left. He climbed down it, staring back up towards the punctured conduit. That tall figure was in the process of clambering out. It wore bulky coveralls, tiger-striped black and grey, and an open-faced helmet with a black visor across the eyes. Below that, an oxygen mask was clamped to its nose and mouth, a rubber pipe snaking back over the shoulder, joining a tank-type assembly on its back. Another of the most futuristic rifles Malik had ever seen was angled back across the figure's shoulder as it moved towards the edge of the catwalk, and gazed down, that burning laser vision spearing through the shadows.
Of course, you can pick up the full version of this. It's still available, and it's available from BBC Audiobooks. So, you've heard enough from me. You've heard enough from Arthur. Let's go and chat to the man behind the adventure. It's Paul Finch.
Hi, my name is Paul Finch. I am a professional author, and one of my contributions to the world of Doctor Who was the novel Hunter's Moon.
Fantastic. It's great to see you, Paul.
And Thank you very much.
It's great to finally chat in person after years of email dealings.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So let's have a wee chat about Hunter's Moon. Do you remember how the commission for this one came about? Because by this point, obviously, you'd had a few Doctor Who credits to your name with Big Finish.
I've got to throw my mind back a little bit. It was a direct spin-off of the Big Finish series. I did about three or four Big Finishes, and it was a direct spin-off from one of those. It was one of those rare occasions where you're sitting in your office, you know, jobbing writers. We never turn work down, and one of those happy occasions when I was suddenly the recipient of an email. I think it was from Justin, inviting me to pitch an idea to BBC Books. Was it BBC Books then? I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah, it probably still is now. Invite an idea to BBC Books, and I pitched an idea. I mean, I didn't want to leave it. I mean, the strange thing in the world of Doctor Who, isn't it? Because, you know, there's literally no limit on the kind of stories you can tell. And it just to be asked to come up with an idea, and I felt I had to do it fairly quickly, just to be asked to come up with an idea, and you've got the whole cosmos to pinch an idea from, they don't come rushing to you. You know, it's kind of, if someone said, tell me a story set in the Wild West, you might sort of be able to come up with something more quickly. I don't know if that makes sense. But anyway, the thing was, I did come up with the idea for Hunter's Moon, and I threw it over, and they really liked the sound of it. And they already knew I could write, so I was commissioned to write it. And it all seemed out very quickly. I do remember going to a meeting in London, but I don't know if it was just for that or for something else. Trips down to London from Lancashire, you know, you try and kill as many birds with one stone as you can. So I probably had two or three meetings. That would have been one of them. But yeah, it all went swimmingly. It just happened very quickly, and I was delighted to get involved.
Any idea where the central concept for this one came from?
When it comes to Doctor Who, my preferred era is John Pertwee, because that's the era when I was at school. Pertwee, of course, was characterised by action. Now, Matt Smith, not so much, but I thought that Matt Smith's likeable boyishness was kind of an interesting thing to throw into an action terror story. So I do a lot of horror. I write action thrillers, and I write a lot of horror. So I thought, well, why don't we up the stakes in this one a little bit? Why don't we turn it into something potentially rather nasty? And of course, you know, alien abduction's a big story. So I thought, I was thinking, oh, what would an alien abduction, what's the conceivable reason? Why would people be being abducted by aliens? I mean, have they not studied us enough? But no, you know, they've got technology that could study us from another galaxy. So I then thought about it, and I then latched onto the idea of an alien criminal organization. And I thought, suppose, yeah, it's the hunting. It's hunting. Big hunt. It's a sort of big game hunting. And they're snatching alien sort of less effective, less physically powerful aliens from them and hunting them like wild animals in a hellscape on a ruined, industrially ruined planet. So there might have been a lot of kind of subtext about all the things going on in the world that bother me. But ultimately, it was just an idea to tell an action-packed story. And I do remember thinking, is this a bit too action-y? Is this a bit too much like an episode of Star Trek? From the Shatner era, of course, you know. But no, I mean, they seemed to really like it. And they told me it was very different from all the other books that were coming out at the time. So I went with it and just got stuck into it.
What I like is the fact that we've got Leisure Platform 9, and it's not the clean sort of sci-fi place that you tend to imagine, you know, places giving you. The fact is it's got a sort of like seedier feel to it with gamblers
things. I can't pretend I'm not influenced by, you know, golden age science fiction, you know, Philip K. Dick, Robert Heinlein, people like that. And the movie adaptations have often gone that way. So you think about films, the obvious one is Blade Runner, but you think about a lesser-known sci-fi thriller, which was has influenced me very strongly, Outland. Do you remember that one with Sean Connery? It was early 80s. And I loved the kind of utilitarian feel. This is where people work. I mean, Alien did it too. These are like industrial places. But also, I think with Leisure Platform 9, I was thinking very much of gangster movies I'd seen, like Casino and Goodfellas. So Leisure Platform 9 wasn't so much a factory complex as it was where people who worked in factories went to let off steam. So it became, it was very much like a kind of space Las Vegas, but a little bit, obviously we couldn't go the whole hog with Las Vegas because there's a slightly younger readership for Doctor Who. So there were certain things I couldn't do, like I couldn't have scenes of drunkenness I couldn't sort of overly titillate the audience with sort of dancing girls and things like that. There's a little bit of that going on, but no one seemed to have a problem with the idea of gambling. So I made it into primarily a gambling mecca for a race of people who are not unlike humans, but weren't humans, but they had similar human urges. They wanted to relax at the weekend and have a good time, you know. And it all seemed to fall into place really quickly, which is usually a good sign. It's usually indicates you're onto something, I think.
I would say I did feel so sorry for Rory being the one who's been captured, and obviously the Doctor and Amy having to get him back, but he's such a joy to write for, I would imagine.
Well, Rory, I mean, when the book first came out, I saw a couple of reviews saying Rory wouldn't do this, Rory wouldn't do that. You know what Doctor Who fans are like, they all have very firm opinions and you can't woe betide you trying to tattle them. But I mean, the interesting thing was that Rory was always a very passive character, and yet I thought, well, I mean, he's well used because he becomes a very key character ultimately, probably one of the most important Doctor Who assistants of them all, really. But he's very passive in the early days, and I thought, I really like the idea of pitching him into a scenario. First of all, he tries to, and he doesn't do this very often, stand up to Amy, show her that he can be a man as well, because he's quite often seen as the sort of the more, shall we say, the meeker member of the partnership, with Amy the kind of firecracker. And so the roles were reversed slightly, and of course he ends up getting in trouble. Now, I mean, I don't know how much we're allowed to give away. Is it a bit late in the day to worry about spoilers?
I think 13 years later, we're okay.
Yeah, I mean, he gambles away the TARDIS, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And obviously, that's putting your foot in it in a big way. And I think that what kind of impact on Rory's psyche that would have, I don't know, but I had a lot of fun with it. Of course, he finds his inner hero as well. When they're on the planet being hunted, he becomes quite a sort of... He has learned things from Amy, and he has learned things from the Doctor. And also, deep down, you know, he's a fairly proficient guy himself. There were still some people who said they didn't think it was Rory, but then when Arthur Darvill, I think, read the narrative, and he just did such an amazing job with it that I think criticism then dried up because people could see Rory actually doing those things, you know. So I mean, I do apologise. It is, I say, it's 13 years ago, and I have to be honest, I've not really thought about it for quite a while. So pulling memories back from the distant past.
That's all right. It's funny how they seem to pop up. I was speaking with another author about a book that he wrote nearly 30 years ago, and he found that details were popping in literally as he spoke, like bubbles above his head. He was like, oh yeah. And all these details popped up, so not to worry. So do you remember how you found capturing this Doctor and Amy and Rory in print? Because I think a lot of what Matt does is very physical, just with the hand clasping and what he does, just the concentration. But I thought that you captured his voice and the companions perfectly.
Well, I'm grateful you say that. It was very, I mean, obviously, you know, Matt was the TV Doctor at the time. So I was very familiar with him. One of the things, I suppose, when you do write for them, when I was writing for the Bill, that earlier era, really, it was a sort of late 90s, early 2000s. When I was writing for the Bill, it was easy to capture the characters because they were so familiar. You know, the actors had inhabited those characters for quite a while. And I think an actor who really, really makes a mark with a character, I personally found that easy to catch. I mean, I thought with Matt, slightly harder because he was playing out of character a little bit. He was pretending to be a sort of uber cool mercenary, which is just not Matt Smith at all. I mean, you could easily imagine John Pertwee doing that, but Matt was slightly different. Matt was such a laid back character that and not particularly authoritative, but he seemed to, so it was a bit of a challenge. I mean, you know, he had to fool this crime syndicate into thinking he was one of the deadliest guns on the Outer Rim. So somehow he managed to do it. I can't remember exactly how it happened now, but I think didn't he have a sort of transmat gun that made it look as if, and he shot someone and they disintegrated, and all that happened was they were transferred back to the local police base, but the gangsters thought he'd actually killed them. So they were impressed by his ruthlessness.
Yeah, I was going to come to that later. It's such a clever twist having that, because you really do think he's done it. And then, of course, all cleverly backed up, and the fact that there's only three shots in the gun as well,
that's the problem you have with Doctor Who, isn't it? You know, and then ultimately he's not Batman. He cannot use extreme violence against his enemies. He has to be clever, which is the appeal of the character, really. I mean, this, of course, is someone who's obliterated entire civilizations.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's destroyed at least three or four Dalek colonies.
Scarrow itself.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't think that we can't give him too easy a ride.
I also love the fact, you know, you get Amy going as posing as a servant girl, and just think that is just so not Amy Pond at all, the fact she's having to play against her natural instincts to fight everything. And I really enjoyed that element too.
Well, that was the fun, inverting the characters a little bit, because you would normally expect Rory to be the one who's told what to do, and he ended up being sort of up to his neck in criminals, and Amy ended up scrubbing floors. But the fun thing you have with, because Amy is a very, very, is a very, another very clear cut character, very spirited. You know, what's that slightly cliched word, feisty. So you can have a lot of fun with characters when you put them in situations they're not happy with. You know, take them out of their comfort zone, put them in there, and I mean, I think she still manages to work a way to do some heroic things eventually. But she's up against a completely different kind of problem, isn't she? You know. She's suddenly a member of the domestic staff, and there's no way out of it. So it was all about having fun with the characters and moving them out of their comfort zone.
I think you definitely did that, and I still feel so sorry for Rory being the prey.
I mean, he had a few sidekicks, didn't he? I think he ended up sort of looking after people, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know, running around across this ruined planet.
How did you find creating your villain of the piece? I imagine that's always fun to do, to come up with a character like Zorg Krautsen and as a brutal crime lord, and just coming up with these bad guys sort of to make them measure up and to give them all the best lines as well.
Well, I mean, the thing I, you know, creating criminals is something I do in most of my writing, is villains. I tend to get good marks from reviewers for my villains. My crime novels, I was once described as having villains that were more like the villains you'd seen James Bond or Batman than in normal crime fiction. I like extravagant villains. I like, you know, most villains in real life are depressing losers. I prefer them to be extravagant elaborately cruel and demented, and to be standout figures in the story. I like clever villains. I always try and give a, if I have a clever villain, I always try and give him a very brutal sidekick, which I think I did in this one. But villains are villains, aren't they? You know, they've got to tick a number of boxes. They've got to be deranged. They've got to be irredeemably evil, and they've got to be clever all at the same time. So that's what I go for.
Yeah, I particularly enjoyed also when the hunt is on. I think there's a little bit of social commentary in there. I think perhaps when you find that the three hunters that are left are a business manager, a stockbroker, and a banker, and it's sort of these ghastly, horrible people who...
That comes from personal experience when I was a police officer, in that, and a rather unpleasant story, really. I won't go into the details, but it involved a dogfighting ring in Manchester. And a number of the people who were arrested and charged, you would not have believed, were involved in something as cruel as this. And they just were people who maintained the facade of being completely normal. You know, they were professional suburban people who everyone thought were normal. I mean, I don't consider people who get pleasure out of cruelty normal. You know, it's a complex world, and some situations arise where any of us can behave badly. But I think premeditated, protracted cruelty, I think that's an aberration. And I found myself quite scared at the thought that a lot of the people living normal lives all around us could have these brutal base desires under the surface. So that's what I wanted to go with. That's definitely one of the reasons I did that. I wanted to stress that villains aren't always monsters. You know, they aren't always drooling madmen. They can look just like us.
Yeah, and I think also the fact you've got people with normal lives that going hunting is just that horrible notion that we quite often see poor animals in the wild that have been shot, and you get like, here's a rich dentist from Ohio.
Yeah, it's something the internet's brought home to us, isn't it? You know, I love animals. I love dogs. I mean, I'm not perfect by any means, you know. But I think that the posing of people with high-powered rifles over the carcasses of magnificent beasts, which didn't stand a chance, frankly, is obscene. If they hunted them with a spear, the way that our ancestors used to do, I might be more impressed. But so there was an element of that in it. Yeah, there was an element of that. It's just a kind of moral vacuum, isn't it? You know, that we've got on this planet. It's all about making the people who organise this in Hunter's Moon. It's all about generating a monumental cash flow by satisfying the desires of cruel people. So it's a bit of a moral vacuum that the Doctor, Amy and Rory find themselves blundering into in this one.
I suppose that's the great thing with science fiction stories. You can actually look at our world and look at these ghastly people and tell stories with them, and at least this way they get their comeuppance, if sadly not all of them do in real life.
We can punish the guilty in fiction. I mean, it's briefly cathartic, but no, you're right. Unfortunately, moneyed villains tend to get away with it.
Yeah. How did you find capturing the feel and the pace of the 21st century series? Because obviously what you've done with Big Finish previously, you'd adapted your dad's amazing script for Leviathan and you'd done your own. So how did you find sort of getting this 21st century pace in print?
Well, I mean, first of all, the brief for the book was only 50 to 55,000 words, which is, 50,000 words shorter than most of my novels. It had to be a fast story. I couldn't spend time spinning off into the outer stratosphere of thought processes and subconsciousness. I just had to get on with the story. You're right, modern TV across the board is much more tightly edited than it used to be. I mean, obviously in the heyday of the sort of classic Who, what you really had was stage plays on screen. You know, you had quite often three walls and then a row of cameras, and the actors were stuck in the middle. I mean, and so it was primarily done through dialogue because they just didn't have the resources to create a big visual experience. It's not the case anymore. So you had to, I had to adapt to that, but it helped that I was telling a quite a big story in a relatively short time frame. About, you know, in terms of sort of, I don't know, let's say 50,000 words, you had to get on with it. So I think I caught the pace. Plus, it was an action-led story anyway. I mean, I can motor through writing when I do the dialogue first. It's probably the inheritance of me starting out writing TV scripts. I always find that helps speed things along, because that's your main interaction. And of course, in the modern style is to not have as much dialogue as we used to do. So yeah, that helps as well. So I must be honest, I didn't consider that I was up against some kind of, you know, that it was an insurmountable obstacle, potential obstacle. I just got on with it, did it? And it seemed to pan out quite well.
Yeah, and I think because you'd shorter chapters as well, which I think helped sort of like keep the action going. So you've got
shorter chapters is one of my fortes. None of my books, I try to keep every chapter to a maximum of about 2,500 words. I mean, if nothing else, that keeps people reading, because once you can, you know, they get to a chapter and they can see the end of the next one, they tend to crack on, you know. And I try to leave hooks at the end of each chapter as well to pull people into the next one.
I think that there's a good psychology in that, because you do like to know, like, how long am I going to be? If I'm starting to get tired, I don't want to find still another 20 pages to go.
Well, these days as well, you've got other distractions, you know. We have people, I think their attention span is so much shorter now than it used to be, because there are so many other things going on all around them, you know.
So what was your thoughts when you first saw the cover for this one?
Well, I mean, you know, I've long ago happy to leave the covers to other people. Covers are all about sellability, aren't they? I mean, I think I'm experienced enough now to see a cover that I think, that's not going to work. Or that's just... doesn't do anything for me at all. You know, I mean, I remember being told that the role of the cover is to get a browser to pick the book off the shelf. And it's the blurb on the back that sells the book. So now this is a sort of psychology of marketing, I suppose. It's a world away from anything I do. So I'm more than happy. So I like it. It caught the eye. You know, it caught the eye. It told quite a bit. You don't actually have to tell the story of what's going to happen in the cover. You know, I've had covers on my crime novels that are quite generic, but they attract shoppers because that's what they're looking for. So it looked fine to me. I mean, it was. I have to say, I think some of the great Target covers in the distant past managed to sell those Target novelizations and produce great pieces of Doctor Who art at the same time. I don't think this one quite ticked that second box, but I don't think that was its purpose.
I think it's a striking enough, definitely. I think all the covers, they work really well. They did a good design template and they worked with that. Now, how did you find the writing process and working with Justin as your editor? I'd assume that it was pretty straightforward.
Yeah, Justin was great. I mean, I've worked with him twice now. He's a great desktop editor. Very helpful suggestions, a light touch, which is good. You know, I mean, I don't mind. I mean, if I'm way off, then I need to be corrected. But I didn't have that with Justin. And we'd agreed the outline beforehand already anyway. So it was really a matter of me getting flesh on the bones. I mean, I had some cuts for violence, I think. Minor cuts for violence. But yeah, it's Doctor Who. You've got to remember what your core audience is. No problem at all. I mean, funnily enough, I dictate all my first drafts before I commit them to paper, and I type them up later on. I don't have an app or anything that does it for me, and I walk the neighbourhood with my dogs as it was then. There's only one left now, and that was in the December of 2010. I was writing that, which you may remember was a big freeze.
I remember it very well.
Yeah, it was a real freeze. It was like sort of minus 14 regularly here, and deep snow, and it was quite a distraction because I knew I had to work fast. I had to have the book in before Christmas, and I thought, well, I'll have no problem. I'll get out there and I'll walk the neighborhood with the dog and I'll blast it onto tape. But it was so cold, it was really quite a distraction because it was eating into me as I was walking around. So, but I had no problem. I mean, I had the story very clearly in my mind. I mean, I was a little bit early on in the book. We had some scenes of kind of broken Britain, you know, domestic scenes where Harry, who's a sort of what a secondary character, Barry Mossett, was struggling to regain his self-respect as much as anything else, and having trouble with his family and And I remember thinking at one point, is this not a bit doer for Doctor Who? This is a bit real life. This is a bit, you know, because they were struggling to pay for their daughter's education. And I thought, this is all a bit depressing, this. So I remember thinking, I better trim these scenes. I don't want to put people off, you know. I don't, you know, it's not, this isn't a kitchen sink drama. It's Doctor Who. But I mean, once I plugged all that into the overall story, I think it was okay.
Yeah. So how happy are you with it now? I think you've probably remembered a bit more than you probably expected at the start of the chat.
It seems I've not thought about it for ages. I mean, I think I remember most things. I do remember the writing process, because I say it was a unique build up to Christmas. It was very, very, very white Christmas that year. So I remember that, and I remember being delighted to get it off before Christmas, get it and feeling relaxed over the holiday. The story itself, I have vague memories of where it went. I think it gets a little bit gory towards the end. It's a battle for survival, isn't it? It ends up being a real battle for survival at the end. I mean, they're all battles for survival, but I think I put the characters through the ringer a little bit in this one. Great. I mean, you know, it stands there. It's got quite a few good reviews online, which is nice. But I mean, Doctor Who's such a fast turnover. You know, we've had two other eras since then. And we've got the third era since then is about to dawn. So yeah, things just fall into the past. And it all happens a bit too quick for me, really. You know, I enjoy savouring these periods, but at least we've got the books and the DVDs and all that, you know, and it's all part of the same kind of, it's all part of the same universe, the same thing, isn't it? You know, so it's, I'm happy with it. You know, I would have been happy to do more, but other work sort of got in the way, you know. So it's a while since I've done any Doctor Who now, I must admit. I think Tales of Trenzalore was the last thing I did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mentioned other work there. So can you maybe tell us a bit about your crime novels and where people can find out more about what you've been up to?
Well, I have a detailed blog online, which I keep updated, update twice a month. That's lots of info there on there. You easily find it, just search for Paul Finch blog. I still do write genre short stories. I love writing short stories. I don't always have time for them. I do my crime novels. I think I've done about 14 to date. I've had a couple of bestsellers there, Sunday Times top 10. So that's been an area that's the most fruitful area for me. As an ex-copper, I suppose you would say, it's kind of an obvious one, really. So I write a lot of crime novels. I'm about to sign a new contract for some more. I've also veered off a little bit into historical adventure. I'm in the middle of a four-book contract to write four medieval action adventures. The first one, The Usurper, was out in March or April. The next one, Battle Lord, is out in January. Then there are two more to follow over the next 2 years. And again, you'll find, if you're interested in buying these, you can find them on Amazon. Or you could order them through Waterstones. They're not in the supermarkets at the moment. I mean, they only tend to stay on the shelf in the supermarkets about a month, mind. But you'll get them up through Waterstones or through Amazon. They're all on there. So, the historical novels are written under P.W. Finch. Paul Finch is the crime writer and the horror and the science fiction writer. The horror anthologies, the Terror Tales series, I've been editing now since around 2011. That's all original horror fiction with a regional flavour. So Terror Tales of the Mediterranean is just about to be published on Halloween, and we go back, there's Terror Tales of London, Terror Tales of Wales, Terror Tales of the North West, Terror Tales of Cornwall, etc. You know, so I'm keeping busy for sure.
Fantastic, glad to hear it. Well, Paul, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real delight to have a wee chat about it, and thank you for taking us down memory lane.
Well, I hope I was interesting enough. As I say, I'm dredging memories up from 10 years ago, so a bit longer than 10 years actually, but yeah, it did seem to flood back a little bit, which is nice.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again.
Thanks very much, Kenny.
Huge thanks to Paul for taking the time to chat. Absolutely brilliant, really enjoyed it. So let's have a quick check in with Doctor Who magazine to see what they had to say about this book. And this is from the review in issue 435, written by friend of the podcast, Matt Michael. There's something primal about The Hunt. It's one of our oldest stories, and this is far from the first time it's cropped up in Doctor Who, but it's rarely been done as well as here. In the same way the TV series manages to make unlikely connections across time and space, writer Paul Finch opens the book with ex-police officer Harry Mossop and his dysfunctional family being abducted by cyborgs and taken to the titular moon, Gorgoror. On Gorgoror, if human beings manage to avoid being consumed by the vicious fauna, they're almost certainly going to be gunned down by the wealthy alien businessmen who paid top dollar to the mobster Krautsen to chase down the most dangerous game. Meanwhile, the Doctor's offhand decision to visit an old friend doesn't exactly turn out as planned when Rory loses first the TARDIS, then himself, and Amy in an ill-advised macho gamble with one of Krautsen's mob. With his ship and his companions gone, the Doctor has to pose as one of the hunters and infiltrate Gorgoror, with surprisingly nasty consequences. In contrast to the ghostly atmosphere of the other two books in this batch, Hunter's Moon has much more in common with Total Recall and Beyond Thunderdome, right down to the unique fashions Amy finds herself modelling after her capture. This is a grimy, gutsy book. The villains are genuinely horrible, philanderers and murderers to a man, and including their number is Zarbatan, whose dead face and psychopathic behaviour put him in the ranks of the Doctor's vilest enemies. There's much violence as well, some of it fairly stomach-churning, Doctor Who for the video nasty generation. And by pitting the Doctor and his companions against such a remorseless bunch, it highlights our hero's brilliance all the better. Because for all that it is a dark book, this never slips into the trap of becoming worse than the material it riffs on. Harry starts the book in a bad place, as does his alien counterpart, the Doctor's old acquaintance, Police Chief Kobol Zalu. However, through their experiences and their interactions with the Doctor and his companions, both Harry and Zalu emerge changed for the better. Despite posing as a vicious killer, the Doctor never stoops to his enemy's methods. He won't carry a proper gun, and his luge Lothario act, complete with rakish snarl as he remembers his past conquests, is ridiculous. Rory is amazing, more amazing than he realises, as he saves the hunted from certain death. And Amy, though written slightly more generically, gets to be sultry, clever, and wonderful. On top of all that, it's fun to spot some of the references to old stories, including the surprise appearance of a monster believed extinct since 1974. There is so much to enjoy about this punchy, pacey novel. It's a compelling page-turner and very highly recommended. Hunt it down at once. So there we go. Matt enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it. And really, is that all that matters? No, we hope you enjoyed it too. That's us, the end of day 11. We'll be back tomorrow with an adventure featuring PCAP's Doctor. Which one? Well, there's not that many original novels to choose from, but I promise you it's a good one, particularly if you're Scottish. So, we are going to head off now and we're going to play out with a track that is actually called Hunter's Moon. And it's from a group called Ghost. I'm not going to deny it, I did Google it. You very nearly got Bad Moon Rising, but I think we might have used that once before. So, until tomorrow, I've been Kenny. Bye bye. It's been a long time coming. I'm coming back for you, my friend. To where we'd hide as children. I'm coming back for you, my friend. It's a hunt.